Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Hi, welcome to an edition of Speaking of Reliability here at RAMS 2020 still, grabbing people to do episodes with. And I'm here with my good friend, Keith Clark from Lincoln Electric Welders. Hey, how's it going, Keith?
Good. Good morning, Adam.
Yeah, good morning. And of course, I have my own personal passion for welding, so I always love hearing about the latest things that you guys are doing, the technology, and to where you eventually want to walk away from me because I won't let you go. Right. I keep asking about what you guys are doing. But not the products. I want to talk with you about your culture and some amazing changes you made. You know, you solicited having an evaluation of your organization and how reliability operates in it and made changes. And you actually did something that I advocate, and I gave it a name. I call it the Reliability Czar. And it's a role that's added onto somebody else's role. It's not the reason why they're hired, but it's something that, you know, can, you know, from program to program, they can even switch, pick up the role or let it go. And it's exactly what you guys created and did. So I wanted to talk with you a little bit about, if you want to talk about the evaluation that was done, some of the things that came out of it, and then this role that actually, you know, you've taken on and that I think will have a huge impact.
Sure. When you're starting with a blank sheet of paper, sometimes it's easier to make changes in an organization, especially when you get support from higher level management. And we were fortunate enough that the president of our organization could see the need for reliability engineering. And even though our company is 125 years old this year, we still didn't have a well-established reliability engineering department. So when you're starting off with that blank slate, you can say, well, what's the best way to do this? Or what are some of the better ways, best practices, and this kind of thing? So we did seek some expert assistance and some guidance. We worked some with Carl Carlson, doing a gap assessment of the organization and finding out what tools we wanted to use. And part of that assessment was also setting up a reporting structure with management on a regular basis. And so I have the privilege of reporting directly to the president of the Cleveland operations there. And that is on a biweekly basis that we meet. And I come into the meetings with agendas so that I don't waste his time. And it's a useful experience for him as well as for me, because I get insights on where he is, what he's thinking about, and then he gets insights into what we're doing and where there's problems in the organization. And it's kind of an interesting dynamic, because on the one hand, you don't want to throw anybody under the bus by exposing where they've been deficient, but on the other hand, you want to look for opportunities for improvement and to spin that in a positive way. So I think it takes some skill to think about, you know, what types of things do you talk about? How do you talk about those in the updates? But I think having a well-prepared agenda has been key to that, and thinking about how to approach it. Because you don't want to give up the trust of other engineers and designers in the organization. And I think that building trust is very key, because if you don't have that, they're not going to be open to change.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. So to be clear, just so the element there that drove when I kind of created this idea of the role of reliability is that direct path of communication from the front lines to an executive, and it has to work well only if there's trust in both directions, the people you're bringing information from, and there's trust on the executive side. And you're bringing that information from the front lines right to them. It's not getting filtered. You know, I always use the analogy about when you spring water, the reason why it's so valuable is it's so pure because it got percolated from the water table all the way up. All the other stuff got removed. But in this case, we want that, and that's what happens. And I think it's especially important with reliability, is because reliability, there's never a VP of reliability, and there shouldn't be. There's VP of quality, VP of R&D, and there's that which brings that element of advisor on those topics to the president. And what you said about trust, for it to work, it has to serve everybody involved. So the people at the front line have to feel you're bringing their message, right? And they have to also be in the mindset that nobody's getting thrown under the bus. That's not the motivation for it. It's entirely to get their information to him. And he has to trust you tremendously, because in effect, he's bypassing his second in commands for this information. So there's risk to him too. So tell me a little bit about the responses you've seen on both ends, both with the, you know, the people that you're bringing the information from at the front lines, and also on his side, and also most interesting, you know, any of the other leadership in between.
Well, I think the interesting thing is that I grew up in the organization as a designer, and so I had a good relationship with many of the designers there, and not only on the engineering design side, but also the manufacturing implementation side. So throughout my career, I've been in different areas. And when you establish those relationships, that's very important, I think, to be able to gaining that trust. But then as you get into the updates and how is it received in the organization, it's nice to understand that there's a lot of time pressure on the part of the engineers doing the design work, or even in the manufacturing side, getting it implemented in time for production. So respecting their time and not being a time vampire is very important.
Oh, yeah.
And I found that because I have the support from the president, they're more likely to listen to the programs that we want to implement, and they're more receptive to it. But I think also because they recognize that we're not there to waste their time, but to do something of value. And the best way to not waste somebody's time is actually to do something of value, and not to just drone on and on about things, but to actually have something of substance.
How do you show them that value? Like, how do you show an engineer that you brought value with the fact that you brought what they might consider delicate information exposing? You know, how do you show them that you brought value?
Well, whenever it comes to trying to get something done, quite often it has to do with solving problems. And engineers value seeing a problem solved. It's often the thing that drives them. It's the thing that they want to think of an outside-of-the-box way to solve a problem.
Yeah.
And so if you can find opportunities to work with them synergically to solve a problem so that they own some of the solution and you own some of the solution, then they recognize that you're bringing value to the table.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's just a matter of highlighting what the really important problems are to work on, like safety-related things.
Well, I was going to ask you for a specific. I know you can't be exactly specific, but you know, kind of in a general sense. So, like a safety issue. You know, what's one you did that you felt had a really big impact and showed the value of this new relationship that's created?
Well, I think the one of the things is that through the DRBFM process, a design review based on failure modes, which you can also do it with FMEAs. But you identify these potential failure modes, and they can have high risk associated with them. And so what we try to do is say, how do I take these high risk areas and mitigate those risks, either by designing it in a different way so that the risk doesn't exist, or to reduce the occurrence or the severity in some way. And so we've had examples of that in DRBFM process where we identified potential failure modes that could be safety related. And then we said, all right, let's really wrestle with this thing. Let's not just test to make sure that it doesn't occur, but let's wrestle with this thing to figure out some neat out-of-the-box ways to actually make a difference. And one example that I think of that came out as a designer, even before we started reliability, was collaborating with manufacturing in such a way to try to think of how to implement a design that was new and novel. And I remember discussing different alternatives on how to manufacture something that had a lot of variation in the process. And I was trying to get an idea from the manufacturer, how do we eliminate this variation? And so he was able to, the subject expert that I talked with was able to identify an alternative path to go so that we could take the idea that I had, but implement it in a way that I never would have thought of without working with him. And together we were able to, you know, create a patent on an idea that actually implemented safety in the field. So finding those relationships of cross-functional expertise, highlighting the problem, and then working synergically on a solution for it is something that is very rewarding.
Yeah.
I think Tatsuhiko Yoshimura said that finding the problems, these buds of problems, and then solving them is akin to innovation. And so that's really something that drives me in reliability engineering is looking for those opportunities for innovation to really make the product safer and more reliable.
Yeah, that is a great point that, you know, sometimes, you know, people who are far removed from reliability think of it as just analyzing data and catching issues, but it is innovation because if you look, I mean, very rarely do some of these amazing technologies that we see were just created out of nowhere. They were done by incremental improvements over decades and decades, right, or hundreds of years sometimes, right? And those improvements are driven very much by this, evaluating and how to improve, and it is part of the innovation process. And I think acknowledging it as part of that, it's a big deal. That's where organizations really surge. So we've talked about this role that I call the reliability czar, and it really was exciting to find out that I had no idea that you guys, you know, you and I talk on occasion, and I had no idea that you guys had done that, and that now you are one, you know, that definition, and it's great to see that there's such positive results. But so let's also now take a step back with regard to, you know, you're describing a situation where a 150-year-old organization is taking a moment of self-reflection and change with regard to reliability. What were some other things that came out of that evaluation that you implemented?
Well, when we did the gap assessment, it became clear that there was certain things in our program that we would do that were not necessarily best practice in reliability engineering. Like, we might have some really good programs to test something before it fails, or to test something to make sure it doesn't fail before you ship it to the field. And we would have a really good, robust program for that, but it was typically single stress type applications. And one of the things that reliability engineering disciplines have brought to the table is this idea of multi-stress failure modes that we hadn't even considered before, because our mindset wasn't even around this idea of stress strength, you know, concept, and what the different stressors are. We just knew that, if you run this at a higher temperature and it seems to pass, then it can ship to the field and that kind of thing. But we were able to identify failure modes that we didn't know why they had failed in the past.
Yeah.
By putting multiple stressors, we were able to duplicate them, like combination for electrochemical migration, for example. We were able to use humidity along with voltage applied and elevated temperature, salt fog, looking at multiple stresses and what can induce failure modes that we had experienced before, but we didn't know how to replicate.
Yeah.
And so this allows us to avoid those proactively. So improving the test program is a big thing that we're bringing to the table with it.
Having a conscious test program that is driven by specifics of your needs and not just out of a textbook or out of a template. That was really fun because last night you and I were talking about it. You know, here at these conferences, they try to have receptions with drinks in the evening to get us to talk about other things. And of course, this is what we end up talking about. You were telling me about this combined stress, you know, program and how you were able to dial it in. And that's exciting to me because that's such a challenge when you're trying to, especially have combined stresses, right? Because now it's not only their individual effect, but the combinations, and to attach it to a model, you know, and you were able to attach it to a model with these multiple variables. And, you know, part of it is locking down certain ones and then figuring out which to vary. But then to have that insane satisfaction of, in the end, matching something that's occurred in the field and now knowing definitively that stress to failure mode relationship is so powerful, because now, as you are innovating and designing, you can in-house bring that closed loop to see if those conditions, you don't have to wait for just to happen in the field, right? Because that's what, to me, that's one of the things that's so hard, you know, for reliability engineers is hoping for being lucky enough to see a failure, right? And then getting to replicate it is the icing on the cake. Yeah. And to have accomplished that is great. Like, you've created something that will work as a tool for all, you know, new technologies, you know, that you innovate. So some of that was use case though, right? Was exploring the use case, like you said, salt fog and other conditions that were those absent previously in your use cases that you defined your product performance in?
Well, we would have single stress tests quite often, but it was very rare that you'd see a multiple combined stress test.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're familiar with in Halt and Haas and that type of thing, where you would have combined stresses of vibration and temperature, but we didn't really do the combined stress very often. It was quite often just single stress, you know, like certain vibration profiles or temperature profiles, but not so much combined. And we do see that there's a lot of failures that we could miss by not doing those combined stress tests.
Right, right. So, and you've shown that value, so now people are going to support it and fund it and give you the time right. and the money to explore it because you were able to show. I mean, well, actually, I should ask that. Do you think that value was clearly recognized to the people who aren't as close to it? So when you're asking a program manager, hey, wait a minute, can we extend our product development program so I can explore this? Are they going to be able to understand the value of it? Or do you think that that value hasn't been communicated or understood in other parts of the program?
Well, I think that they do see the value in it now. I think that another thing that we do...
Wait, can I ask you who they is? Is they like yeah. project managers that are very far removed from some of that? You know, for them, you know,
yeah,
you
quite
ask
often
project
the new
manager,
product managers.
Yeah, yeah. Right? You ask them what's important, and they're like, "Well, yeah. there's three things that are important to me: schedule, schedule, and schedule."
Yeah,
right?
Right.
And that's what you're up against, you know. And I understand it, and I empathize with them because that's what they're being pressured on. Like, they're right. it's personal. They're probably their bonus is probably tied to it, right?
Yes.
Like, it's food on the table kind of stuff. And so I get it. So for them to, you know, they are kind of one of the benchmarks of if the value is really acknowledged. Yeah. So how about them, project managers? If you talk about what occurred with this, were they like, oh, yeah, okay?
So initially, they're very skittish to get involved in anything that they perceive as being a roadblock,
right.
potentially to developing products. So the approach that we took was that we're more of a service organization to help them and to assist them.
Yeah.
So quite often, we'd find ways to do the testing in parallel with what they're doing and sometimes take on something that they might normally do
yep.
while developing it so that they actually in the long run get to the end goal faster than they would have before.
Yep.
And that was the whole driving force.
They
I wanted to
it.
Help them to get there faster
yeah, they get
by
it.
Planning it well.
Right.
And the beauty of it is that they avoid lots of revisions to the product down the road that they would have to do to get to the same quality
yeah,
point that they're at
yeah,
now.
The recovery phase. So that's the
right.
thing. Do they see the connection between the true time in the market, which includes the recovery phase after you go into production and something happens?
I think the ones that...
They did.
Yeah, I think the ones that we're working with have seen that. We haven't worked
wow.
with every product group yet,
wow.
but when you get those wins like that, it has a tendency to catch like wildfire and
it.
The word gets out.
Man, that's
so
awesome. Well, you're driving. I mean, because
yeah.
for me, the big thing is culture. I think that's the next big phase of the reliability discipline. And your story is almost textbook. It almost sounds fairy tale-ish to me for what I experienced,
yeah.
where you came into this evaluation. This is our gap. And you know, you created the role that I call the reliability czar, and project managers are like, oh, I see how this helps me. You're not
yeah.
even fighting them anymore. They're like, help, can you? They're probably coming to you
yeah,
for some of this because they
are
see a time
a lot
savings.
Of pull from them
Man.
For assistance on things, and that's exciting.
I don't know if it, the podcast, you know, it's only audio, but they can't, there's a glow around you right
yeah,
now.
Right.
There's like a halo to glow. I think maybe you're sitting
yeah.
in front of the window. I don't know, but
right,
that's what
yeah.
I'm seeing. It's pretty awesome.
No, it is. It's very rewarding and it's fun and it's a win-win because not only do we get to expand the reliability program so that we have safer equipment, you know, more reliable equipment, but it also is it's a big win when you continue to grow relationships that are good and with mutual respect
yeah.
you know, for others.
Yeah. yeah, and the difference between, I think a great metric to how well it's working is the difference between push and pull, right?
Yeah.
So if you're pushing this, you know, on people, even sometimes engineers, because, you know, they're not as worried about schedule. Maybe they're worried about, you know, R&D and developing a new feature or cost point. Or, and then when it changes to a pull, they're coming to you. You've created a magnet mm-hmm. of where they get that what you're doing satisfies what they need. That's a fantastic, you know, measurement of what's happening. So how about with engineers now? With the engineers who... you know, probably, you know, who did suffer with the fact that those failures were occurring in the field historically.
Yeah.
Can you describe a little bit of the change in relationship with them?
Well, I think the key thing is that they see that there's another way to get help in solving problems. And so whenever they perceive that and they believe that it's real and that they can actually get some help on it, then they're going to look for ways to engage with that.
Yeah.
And the goal is to not try to take credit away from them or whatever, but to actually work on win-win. So I remember Stephen Covey talked about something about making a pie bigger, which was akin to this abundance mentality versus a scarcity mentality where
yep.
one person tries to take credit over what somebody else
right,
is doing.
Right. You want to be a good supporting actor.
Right.
Right.
And so if we can find ways to grow the pie together, which to me means we're making more reliable, more profitable, more, you know, more safe equipment by making that pie bigger together, it's rewarding, and we don't have to worry about who's getting the bigger slice of that piece of pie.
Yeah. And I know, talk about your equipment. I know I diverted from it because I can go on and on about it. But, I mean, I have a Lincoln welder, TIG welder in my basement. It's what I do my welding projects with. And I've shown you some of the crazy pictures of welding I've done with it.
Upside down and a deck and that type of thing.
On the water. Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. That was the one when I first met you I showed you was – so I got a – I had a an electrician make a 25-foot cable so I can run my 220 out to the water because I live on the lake.
Yeah.
And as soon as I did that, I had no idea that all my neighbors were going to, you know, it's like buying the best lawnmower in the neighborhood. They all want to borrow it. So all of a sudden, everybody started showing up with welding stuff that they needed done on aluminum and stainless for their boat stuff. And my neighbor came by with his floating dock, which used to be a pontoon boat, these two huge pontoons. And at the base of it, there were these plugs that leaked. So he's like, can you help me fix this? Because now my welder can get to the water. Yeah. So we actually brought it up. We jacked it up, but it's still in the water. And I hung over the side, TIG welding upside down, while he held my feet. And we got this picture of it. And I was like, I'm not just into your reliability. I'm a fan of your product. But also, I will say that I really was blown away by the features in your products because the TIG welder I used before was one of those absolutely huge industrial big blue ones that are like you see in the back of trucks, you know, the old Miller 250s that have resistors that are the size of, you know, coffee cups.
Yeah.
And I loved it.
Because
it
would very unfortunate choices.
Yeah, but it would never break, right? It was meant to be left out in the snow kind of thing. And then I have a smaller workshop now, so I bought one of your modern ones, and it is unbelievable the amount of control. It's like there's an expert welder inside of there making adjustments live. It blows my mind every day how this smaller unit has that power and the ability to give me that control and even the kind of automated parts of it too. So
that's the inverter technology with power switching devices.
Yeah,
it really revolutionized the way welding is done.
Yeah, the results are there. There's no question that, you know, the results are.
You know, one of the exciting things that we're getting into now is additive welding, where you have robots that you can download a program to whatever shape that you want it to make, and it 3D prints it basically by welding.
That's a game changer, right? Because that's been the big thing with 3D printing is getting the material properties that you want, the structural and all that. And so now to have that, because what you've brought to it, what stopped welding being, you know, historically a big part of 3D printing is, you know, the accuracy, right? You know, the surface, you know, the plus or minus tolerances, and because of the controls you've brought to it, now you can get to it. And so neat. And none of that innovation can happen if reliability is not engaged with it, because nobody wants the new features if they fail half the time. You can't sell that.
Right.
Yeah, that's great.
So it's exciting to see things like that and higher productivity, you know, looking for win-wins with the customers where if they can produce more in the same period of time with excellent quality, then, you know, you get a pull from the customer too. And so that's some of the stuff we're looking for in the new product development.
Yeah, that's great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk.
Sure.
These are really great. And to our audience, if you have any comments or questions, we love seeing comments, you know, and getting a chance to interact with you. And so thank you again, Keith.
Sure, absolutely. My pleasure.
All right.
Good talking with you, Adam.
You too. Take care.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.